This is the Senate Committee on Labor Concern and Business Affairs meeting here in B at 8 o'clock a.m. on Friday, April the 22nd. The Senate Committee on Labor Consumer and Business Affairs meeting in Hearing Room B at 8 o'clock a.m. on Friday, April the 22nd, 1977.
Yeah, there. Yeah, let's go to SJR 6 first.
Yes, James.
This is the Senate Committee on Labor Consumer and Business Affairs. 1977.
I feel good today. Yeah, that's a conversation. You know what the Indians call right now? I think I'm going to be the first speaker on the field by today.
We do have a quorum.
Quorum being present, the committee will come to order. First bill we'll hear this morning, or not here, but have a work session on, is Senate Joint Memorial 6. We've had a hearing on this, and what it does memorialize Congress that funds spent in aid to employment be directed to aid unemployed persons and finding point rather to upgrade the presently employed persons. I don't know if you recall doing those.
Basically, the bill is a memorial to the Congress. Asking that the emphasis be placed on any money spent in regard to employment be directed at new jobs. And we have heard the testimony on March 28th, and there were no people testifying against it.
Mr. Chairman, I move it out due pass.
Seems to me like we did have some suggestions for amendments, didn't we? Did anybody look at those?
I don't recall any suggestions for amendments on that. Do you have any notes?
No, Gary Pagenstecker of Salem, Oregon Association of Employment Services, was the only witness.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
As I remember the testimony on that, on this bill, as we the testimony proceeded and the questioning proceeded, it came out that the intent of this memorial was to encourage government to use private employment agencies as much as possible to not only go to the public sector to find jobs, help people find jobs.
And it seems to me also, Mr. Chairman, that when we talked about this, if we suggest that they restrict appropriation for employment programs to those that provide employment only for the unemployed, what about the underemployed? What about various groups, minorities and women and others, who maybe need to have some help in improving their job situation?
Well, this is directed, of course, they are unemployed, or some of those are unemployed too, the minorities, and of course this would affect them also.
But it says to restrict appropriations to those things, as though you can't appropriate for anything else. Why don't we just say to appropriate for, leave out restrict?
Wait, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Jernstad.
It says, whereas Congress should give priority to the problems and stress employment of the unemployed. That doesn't mean they can't go ahead with
we're talking about the resolve itself.
On line 17.
Yeah. The resolve is the important part, the whereas is.
I'm sure it's very important.
Okay. Yeah. It usually ends up in the realm. Many times that ends up in the round file, I would imagine. But you want to offer your amendment, Senator Crow?
Congress is moralized to appropriate for unemployment programs.
just say stress instead of restrict.
Okay. That would be better.
Or encourage.
Encourage.
Okay. To encourage.
I'm under stress. I like
this. You want stress?
He wants
no, I don't.
Stress.
Where are you placing it?
What? Okay.
You're replacing restricting with stress.
On 17. Restrict on line 17. But encourage. Okay. Senator Crowe moves that on line 17 after the word to, that the word encourage be with that we delete the word restrict and add the word in encourage. Is there any objections to this amendment?
Yes.
Hearing none. Do you object?
Yes.
Okay, you have a better suggestion?
I think that it's sort of bizarre to say that Congress should encourage appropriation. I just don't think that's appropriate language. And I also think that we all know that memorials are very symbolic gestures, and what we're trying to do is to indicate that we want to have the employment funds used for employment purposes as opposed to ancillary programs which are not directed at the problems of the main problem of unemployment. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with it in its present wording.
Would the word direct make more sense?
Direct would be less restrictive than restrict.
Okay.
Do you agree with that one, Mary?
I don't care.
Okay. Senator Crowe
changes
his opinion, and now the word is changed from restrict to direct. Are there any objections to this amendment? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Senator Crowe moves. Senator?
No, I don't.
Okay, who does?
I move it to the floor with Senator Crowe carrying the bill.
No, you don't.
Senator Roberts moves SDM to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
We're changing the word, to restrict direct on 12 and 17. Is that correct?
Just 17.
Just 17.
Let's look at 12. Should restrict. I think we better change it on 12.
Okay. Okay. Also included line 12.
Yeah.
No.
Aye.
Senator Grinstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trill?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Okay, the motion is carried. Let's go to Senate Bill 718. I believe there are amendments.
Yes, they
have been distributed around.
Or not.
Okay, the only change in there, and there was some concern, and if you can see the amendment, the section does not impair the right of insurer to establish proof of loss requirements for motor vehicle liability insurance policy and investigate and determine through its agents or employers the amount of the insured's loss. In other words, they would have the right to go to the shop and see that, and check the bid and see that it is proper and in order. There are those that felt that they could have done it under the original bill, but this makes it more clear.
Move the amendment.
Okay, Senator Grinstead moves the adoption of the amendments. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
I move the bill to the floor of the due pass, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roberts moves the floor, Senate Bill 718 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
No.
Senator Grinstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trill?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Okay, motion as carried. Let's go to
Who do you want to sign that?
SJR 19. This was a recommendation of the committee, the interim committee on trade and economic development, that in 1973 we passed the Uniform Collective Bargaining Act, and as a result of a Beaverton and I believe it was Hermiston decision, it was found that. The court determination was that it didn't apply to cities or counties that had home rule. So what this would do is refer to the people of the state, to the voters at the next statewide primary election, to make that determination. It was the intent of the legislature at that time that we would have statewide uniform collective bargaining. Yes, 73. But through the court determination, all this is a referral to the people to make that decision.
Is the bill ready, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, the bill is ready.
Move to floor, do pass.
Senator Troll moves SJR 19 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
No.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstad?
No.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Troll?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Let's go to the motion as carries. Senate Bill 60. Senator Hannan, was there a bill here that I know you had to get back to Ways and Means that we were...
Senate Bill 63.
63, okay. Senate Bill 63.
We're losing our whole crowd.
Yeah.
Okay, was there an amendment?
There were some minor amendments made previously and adopted on this bill.
Frank, are these amendments, these are the ones submitted by Tom Bassinet. Have you seen them?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, do you want to comment?
Yes, and also, there is another amendment that the insurance commissioner, I can't remember, it's been so long since the hearing was held on this bill, I don't remember whether these amendments were submitted earlier or not, but we found that one of the two amendments that Austin Crowe had submitted had not been incorporated in those two amendments that legislative council prepared. And we subsequently, the commissioner felt that second amendment should be included, and we discovered something that we thought could be improved in the drafting of one of those two amendments. And so the insurance commissioner has prepared a proposed substitute amendment dated March 23rd, 1977, that includes the two legislative council amendments and makes the necessary corrections.
Yeah, you're right.
Are these your amendments that are just being passed out now?
What are they dated, Senator?
They're undated.
These are the ones that start out engrossed with 323 insurance commissioner's amendments.
Yes, that's a hand-engrossed version that includes the March 23rd, 1977 amendments, and I think you have a set of those March 23rd amendments. Mr. Bessonette's amendment, excuse me.
Senator Wires?
Where do these differ from Mr. Bessonette's amendments as to policies other than drafting?
Only in one respect. They are identical except for the fact that Mr. Bessonette's amendments provide for an unspecified amount of a deductible from the obligations of the Guarantee Association, and they also provide that that same deductible is applied against the use of the deposit that the insurers file with the commissioner, so that the obligations that the deposit is held for and the obligations of the Guarantee Association are identical and would be subject to an initial blank dollars, 50, 100, whatever the committee determines against the claims, whereas the commissioner's amendments that were included in the original bill wipe out the present $100 deductible against the guarantee fund's obligations.
Well, could we, if we set the level and add that to your amendments, would we have taken care of all the questions that are also in Mr. Bessonette's amendments? Is that the only thing left to do?
Yes, as far as all the parties that I'm aware of that have an interest in this bill, that's the only unresolved question.
Well, I move the insurance commissioner's amendments with a $50 deductible.
In other words, instead of the company being liable for the entire $100, it'd be liable for $50. Is that...
Well, under the insurance commissioner's proposal, there would be no deductible.
That's right.
Yes. Under the Bessonette amendments dated April 18th, there would be a deductible of some amount. Whatever.
Of some amount?
Some amount. It's not specified. It's left.
Up to the determination of whom?
Well, it would be the determination of this committee when they act on the bill.
I see. What is an insurance commissioner's position as far as the deductible? As I understand, he's unalterably opposed to any deductible.
Well, I don't know that there's any such thing as unalterably opposed.
Well, we like to know his. I would like.
Well, the commissioner clearly prefers that there be no deductible.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Wires.
Isn't there some argument, a de minimis argument about handling, paper handling and so forth, that it's cheaper to have it fall on the consumer than it is to process the paper that might end up costing as much as the... Isn't there a de minimis argument here?
Yes.
Where is the de minimis argument cut?
I think... Let me state the issue as I see it. Different people may see it differently. The Guarantee Association is regarded as a last resort, and it was felt when the Guarantee Association law was originally passed that it wouldn't hurt to have the general loss claimant bear a small part of the loss, such as $100. However, in practice, and it is true that this does eliminate a lot of the nuisance or the very small claims, especially where you are allowing unearned premiums for the first time. This bill would give people the claim of their unearned portion of the premium against the Guarantee Association. Where the rub comes, basically, is that many insurance agents are undertaking to make whole their insureds when they lose the $100 under the present law. And while an individual may afford to lose $100, if an agency has a large number of customers in a particular insolvent insurance company, this becomes a very heavy financial burden for the agency to have a large number of $100 claims or obligations that the agency feels morally obliged to cover.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
How many claims would that amount to then? What are we talking about?
Well, an individual...
20, 100?
An individual agency could have several hundred, I suppose.
Or it could just have one or two?
Yes.
So we're not talking about a great deal, are we?
Well, $10,000, $20,000 as a maximum, I would judge.
How usual would that be for a maximum then?
Well, the insolvent carrier situation has to date chiefly affected these automobile insurance companies writing in the substandard market, and certain insurance agencies specialize in that business. So they tend to get a heavy concentration of their insureds in that one company, and as it has happened, maybe several companies in a row that agency has done business with have become insolvent. And so, you know, it gets up into the tens of thousands of dollars.
It could be if it's five or six, and it costs if the agent's trying to keep his client happy and have to pay $100 or $50 even, it's a little, it could be $500 or $1,000 or $1,500. Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just
it's okay, Senator Carson. You can interrupt me anytime.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. Today's okay. I think you've answered this before, Frank, but most of these collapses, except for perhaps an October day windstorm, most of these collapses are in the high-risk automobile casualty field, aren't they?
That's the way they have been.
In other words, the people that we're talking about are the agents and the insureds who are at the far end, the risk pool, the bad drivers, the great risks to begin with. In other words, what I'm getting at is they're in a pretty shaky risk field to begin with. It has been the history, if I think
that's been the history.
Okay. I'll make a statement. You don't need to respond to it. Mr. Chairman, I think what we're talking about are people that are in a pretty shaky insurance position anyway. These are people that have either gone through a series of insurance companies and they've dropped them and they're at the far end of risk. And the question really is, I think, is the guarantee fund is if the local agent wants to voluntarily, for good business purposes, cough up and pay the $100 in the return premium, unearned premium, I think that's his business. We're taking a step forward and saying the fund is going to pick up the premiums. But I think we've got to keep in mind that we're not talking about the normal insured. We're talking about the guy that's already in a heavy risk area. He's paying very heavy premiums. He probably knows that he's in a peculiar area, and our responsibility
are you
stops.
Saying that then that the substandard companies that write substandard insurance are the only ones that are shaky and could go into the hands of receivers? Or
that's been the history, I think, from what Frank has said. I don't want to, there, as you know, it's a crime to impugn in Oregon. Crime to impugn the insolvency of any insurance company. That's in the old days when lobbying really was lobbying. That's one of our state laws now. So I don't want to impugn the solvency of any insurance company. I don't want to go to jail for it, which is a ridiculous law, frankly, but it's there. But I do think that, I'm not up on the word substandard, but I do know that what we're talking about is even getting the insurance, maybe you ought to be insured separately for going with those insurance companies, because you are out in the fringe, if I understand Frank's testimony, where they've collapsed. They're the ones that are insuring the risk drivers. And, So the question is, should those of us that are back in the mainstream cover those exceptional risks?
What is the, I would like to know, Frank, what is the amount involved if the 100 deductible, if all, we're all paid, I mean, including the 100 deductible, but just the 100 deductible, what would be the cost of this, the estimated cost? And
by the guarantee tax, association?
The guarantee association, the total.
Well,
for annually based on what we've experienced in the past.
Based on the experience in the past, and I'm just going to have to guess, Mr. Chairman.
But I
would say that it probably would increase the obligation of the guarantee association by 50% or something in that neighborhood.
Would be.
Excuse me. That's with the unearned premium covered. I'm sorry.
Just the 100 deductible.
Just the 100 deductible. Well, I suppose there are five to 10,000 insureds that have been affected by this. 5,000 may be a reasonable guess.
Annually? So,
well, no, to date, over the last 4 years. So that's about $500,000.
Over the
5 year period.
That would be on the deductible.
The $100 deductible.
It would be that much in 5 years, $500,000, about $100,000 a year then, on the 100 deductible loan. That seems awfully high.
Well, I'm just, you know, if I think there have been at least 5,000 insureds affected by these five or six insolvencies that we've had in the past since the Guarantee Association has been in effect.
And, I see. But did they all have 100 deductible?
Well, they all would. Almost all would have an unearned premium.
Yeah.
Some of them might not have that much unearned premium.
The motion was 50 deductible. Your motion was 50 deductible, right?
Mr. Chairman, the a question has come up in my mind now about whose ox is going to get gored with this. It sounds to me like there's another issue here that I hadn't understood clearly before, and that is the agent from the testimony we're getting here this morning. I want to be see if I'm understanding this. The part of the problem is that the agent who's selling the insurance for that agency would try to make this good to the customers, and that while it might not fall, it might not be a grievous burden on a high-risk insured, like a person who had accidents and was getting insurance at a very high cost, if the agency wanted to maintain their good name in the community, they might try and go out and pay these people all off, and then it would fall on. So it's a question of, we've got the poor guy that's got his insurance, and then we've got the agents on one side, and we've got the insurance company on the other. Is that where we're trying to see?
Well, yes, and just to make my position clear, the commissioner personally recommended to wipe out the $100 deductible and include the unearned premium. Both of those were innovations. Adding the unearned premium adds a substantial amount to the obligation of the Guarantee Association. As I understand it, the Guarantee Association people, and I'm not really lobbying or speaking for them, but I'm familiar with these amendments, and you haven't asked them to explain them, so I'm doing the best I can. They are willing to go along with the unearned premium coverage by the Guarantee Association, but they are rather strongly opposed to including the first dollar of obligation. And so I suppose it's fair to say it's a compromised position, that they'll accept the guarantee, the unearned premium obligation, if you're willing to put a deductible in.
Well, as yet, we've only heard from one company that was in opposite, that felt that the 100 deductible was, or that if they had to pay it, was unjustified. And I believe that was Oregon Mutual.
Threatening to launch agencies out of business.
Term, are the commissioner's amendments ready to be moved?
Yes.
I move the commissioner's amendments.
With the 50 or what, in it, without deductibles?
I think without.
Okay. Senator Crow moves the Commissioner's amendments without deductible. Are there any objections to Senator Crow's?
Well, I move it be amended with a 50 deductible.
Will you? Okay.
Okay. He moves that there's a motion
to
amend the...
That was made before.
Yeah. Okay. He withdrew his motion.
He withdrew his motion.
It was never accepted, so...
Okay.
There's a move to amend Senator Crow's amendment by substituting for zilch to $50.
Come on, Mr. Chairman.
That's zip, not zilch.
Nothing. So, what is your... let's call the roll on that.
All right. Senator Carson?
Aye.
On what?
Senator Hannum?
Aye.
Senator Jernstein?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Okay.
I know what I'm being.
Frank? For clarification, then, could I just identify what you have adopted as some amendments dated April 18th, 1977? With a $50 inserted where there's a blank.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we haven't quite adopted. We've taken the amendments and added the $50 to them, and now we're about to adopt
these. All right. But the amendments have been adopted, dated April 18th.
No.
I'm sorry.
They haven't been adopted. All we did was, at that time, was to adopt the...
Well, what you're referring to as April 18th were those submitted by Tom Bessonette.
Yes. No.
No.
We went after yours.
Well, they're identical except for that deductible feature.
Well, we took yours and added. Senator, Mr. Chairman, if I might, let's test and see if I understand what's going on. Senator Trow moved your amendments.
Yes.
Senator Jernstein moved your amendments, or moved to amend your amendments by adding the $50 deductible. Body part's been adopted, so we have your amendments with a $50 deductible.
Didn't he amend my motion?
Well, all right, I just...
Now, you just said that the amendments of April 18th were identical to yours of the March 23rd. Is that correct?
Yes, except for the deductible feature.
Right.
That's it. That's we're ready to vote on the amendment as amended.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Crow makes a motion that we adopt the amendment.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any objections?
On which... amendments
now? The amendments are adopted.
These would be the amendments of April 18, 1976 with a $50 deductible. 77.
That's the way I understand it.
Okay.
Thank you, Frank.
Why don't we call a roll on that, just to make sure it's legal?
Why don't we call a roll and see who's confused?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you want to call a roll on
this? This is on the insurance commissioner's amendments.
Amendments, yeah. Right.
As amended.
Yeah. All right. Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannum?
Aye.
Senator Jernstein?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Okay, move to the floor, do pass.
Motion is carried. Okay. Senator Carson moves... Senate Bill 63 to the floor with a due pass as amended with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
For the sake of future discussion and floor debate and all that, I would like to have on the record why this isn't going to have an impact on an agent, this $50 deductible.
Okay.
It is.
It is.
It is.
All right. Why that impact on the agent, in the opinion of the committee, isn't great enough that we should... that it's all right to go ahead and leave it in.
The impact on the agent would be public relations. If he fails to reimburse if he doesn't get his full refund back, the insured is going to be unhappy with him. Even though it isn't his fault, the insured will blame the agent.
Yeah, the interested parties are all the other insureds.
Right.
That are companies that don't fail, because they're picking up the tab. The insurer whose company's collapsed, and the agent. Those are the three people, and we've shifted, I'm lobbying now, we've shifted a substantial increase onto those who are insured in companies that don't fail because of the unearned premium aspect. we refuse to ship up to $50, we ship everything above $50 onto the, in other words, $50 stay between the agent and the insured.
Yeah.
And obviously the number one loser is the guy who's insured with the failing company.
And it's up to the agent whether he wants to pay the insured reimbursement or not. It's not the agent's responsibility.
Yeah.
So we're not going to run him broke. We're just, if he doesn't have enough $50,
he doesn't have enough good
weather, he's going to have some people unhappy.
That's
we're
right.
Improving his situation. From the
but it's, it is bad PR for an agent.
I know what we've done now, for sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Roberts.
I think it's important, too, to assume that if we're talking that the most of the bulk of these are with the high-risk companies, there's two other facts that are true. The premiums are going to be extremely high, A. B, the agent's commission on getting those accounts is probably also, is usually based on the amount of premium, right?
Well,
it may be different in
a
high risk.
Commission on the premium. The premium, the commission is quite, is much lower usually on substandard business than it is on...
I don't know what that amount is. In regular insurance.
I don't know. It's 15%. It's probably down to 10 now. And in fact, I doubt if the companies are paying them anything.
And the insurance agent who chooses which. Also, the insured agent, if they have a number of companies, they don't necessarily have to choose those companies that are. In their estimation, the highest risk. Obviously, they're not always going to know, but there is a certain amount of responsibility on their part, too.
That's right, but this doesn't always happen. A company can go broke off very quickly if they have a bad year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
What's the Latin expression for time passes?
Tempus
futurum. Tempus, okay, it's passes.
Okay, we have Senator Carson moves Senate Bill 63 to the floor with the new pass amendment to the floor with the new pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Mr. Senator Wire?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Senator Jernstead will carry this.
I don't know.
Move the Senate Bill.
May not.
626.
Oh. We both hands, Ken. We both hands.
Are there any amendments to that? Do you want to come out
no
the bill?
No further amendments to 626. I believe the committee adopted some amendments that the insurance commissioner offered last hearing.
Do you want to go over just briefly and
okay.
We had a hearing on
this. This is model legislation passed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners that will permit the insurance companies to calculate their reserves at a higher rate of interest than the law now permits it. The law restricts the amount of interest that an insurance company can calculate its reserves. Investment yields have been going up. For most policies, the interest rate is now 4%. It will go to 4.5%. What this actually means, in effect, is that premiums can be lower because you can have less amount of money to start with and assume a higher investment return on that reserve. There's no, this is not a controversial bill with one exception that I want to mention. It's being introduced in all states now in an attempt to get model legislation so that all insurance companies can use the same figures in calculating their reserves on policies they sell in all the states. The one area where we run into a little discussion last hearing was the life expectancy of females is longer than the life expectancy of males. The present law on life insurance permits the insurance companies to calculate a 3-year age differential. in determining their reserves. In other words, the effect of it is that on life insurance policies, a female at the age of 35 would pay the premiums at the rate of a male at 32. This bill permits the insurance companies to increase that age differential to 6 years. So there'll be a further decrease in the premiums for females.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Roberts?
What is the reason that this policy is being pursued?
The National Association of Insurance Commissioners have had a study committee working for 2 years on this in this area.
What other issues have they studied in terms of differentials of lifespans of different groups besides just male and female?
Well, age-wise, you mean? There's statistics that
different
the insurance.
You know, you said they've studied the area of differential between male and female. What else have they studied?
Well, I'm not an actuary, Senator, and I'm really not the best person to try and explain this. I think maybe Mr. Howlett is better qualified. This is really not Standard Insurance Company's bill. It's a bill that is adopted as model legislation by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. The insurance companies support it strongly. I know what your problem is, and I understand your problem, and I don't think, even if I was a qualified actuary, I would be able to satisfactorily answer the question that you...
Right, well, it's not only my problem either.
I understand that.
It's just one of your problems.
No, I'm saying that it's going to be a problem with a lot of people that feel that this practice does have a discriminatory impact, and it's...
Well, I believe it's also discriminatory that a male has to pay higher insurance rate premiums.
I completely agree.
No, can it be discriminatory when it's based on fact?
I don't think it is.
Not on prejudice.
Not at all.
Not on tradition.
Just like the fact that there's no differential between blacks and whites in this policy when the actuarial tables will show a difference.
I don't think it's a significant difference.
It is a significant difference. And I think that...
In life?
In life, yes.
Hmm. Okay.
And the decision has been made that politically you can't make that differential on the basis of race. You get all sorts of, you know, what if you did that. But if you can do it on the basis of sex, you can get away with it at the present time in our society with the present assumptions about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And that's what I'm objecting to.
I think we can carry this word discrimination
I'm
on.
I'm sure that it will pass out of this committee.
Well, that's not the station of ultimate repose, however.
Okay, what is your pleasure?
Move the bill for due pass.
Senator Crow moves Senate Bill 626 to the floor of the due pass recommendation as amended. So, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
No.
Senator Crow?
Aye.
Senator Wires? Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion is carried. Let's go to 297. I think we have someone here from the Department of Labor.
They're getting quickly.
We have a name. So.
Senator Crow, would you carry this bill?
Which one? 626.
Yeah, 626.
626. Well, this is not my area of expertise.
Well, why don't
okay. Well, okay. I need to know if it is their bill.
Oh, you're okay. I see, okay.
Well, if I...
I think this is a bill for you.
I think you ought to carry it, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm going to ask Wally. This is a...
Well, okay, if Senator Roberts just kind...
Committee on 297. Do you want to discuss those amendments?
Mr. Chairman, it's been some time. I think we have general concurrence of the... we met Jack Kononowski, Jerry Christine, and Bill Stevenson, and I met and tried to iron out our difficulties, and my recollection is that what you have in front of you now is a bill that the industry and the employers, or the labor and employers and the labor commissioner all find satisfactory. And I think Mr. Wolf is around here somewhere.
Right here.
That might speak to specifics.
Can you speak to it as quickly as possible? We have probably 25 minutes.
Give him 2 minutes.
We'll give you 2 minutes, right.
Senator Carson is correct that the parties involved, labor, industry, Bureau of Labor, and Senator Carson, I believe, are in agreement on the amendments proposed here. There are some changes from the original bill. If you want to go through them step by step, I can. I don't know how much time you want to take on these.
Sure.
I think basically we are more specific in indicating under what circumstances the commissioner may adopt the federal rate, and that's only if the information is not available.
Could I interrupt? That was one concern, that he would just quit. He would not even look at the communities and would immediately adopt the federal rate for the state of Oregon. And that's the intent here, is he has to work through a process before he can go. It's a backstop only to go to the federal rate. Also, the second thing was to do a little better job of defining the collection of areas that he would set a prevailing wage rate for.
Senator Carson, do you wish to move the adoption?
I'll move the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Carson moves the adoption of amendments to Senate Bill 297. Ms. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trowe?
Aye.
Senator Wires? Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Amendments have been adopted.
Another change you might touch on, John, was the effect of a prevailing wage rate change in the midst of a contract.
Okay.
I've forgotten how we handled that. That's on page 4, I think.
The language now reads, page 4 will be line 12 beginning, in the event of any new determination by the labor commissioner of the prevailing rate of wage, every contractor or subcontractor shall be required to pay no less than the amended rate or rates to workers on public works as defined in subsection 3. That means as the rates change, then the wages paid will have to change commensurate with the change in the prevailing rates.
We already accepted them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is the bill ready?
Anything further? The bill's ready. I think that
there are a number of other amendments, but
Carson has done a great job, and
well,
we all have
you,
a great
Chairman,
deal of confidence.
Senator
Carson. Senator Carson moves the bill to the floor for the due pass recommendation as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Trowe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. I want to ask Senator Wires to carry that bill, and you can notify him.
Are you going to deal with it?
Let's see. We have, we'd like to go to Senate Bill 988. We have, I think you have some amendments.
I'll stay around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Marcus from Senator Wingard's office. And 2 weeks ago, Senate Bill 988 was presented before the committee by Senator Ripper and Senator Wingard. And this bill appropriates $1.5 million for youth employment over the next 2 years, and it will subsidize employment for approximately 4,000 youths over that time. When the bill was presented, Senator Roberts asked us to draw up some amendments so that the language more accurately states the bill's intent. And these amendments are those. Basically, this amendment, I think you have a copy, does two things. One, it makes sure that an employer does not fire someone who is presently being working for him in order to hire someone at a cheaper rate. And it also encourages employers, obligates employers to hire these youths after the 10-week period for the job that they were holding at a subsidized rate. And I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Yeah, are there any questions?
Move the amendments.
Senator Crowe moves the adoption of the amendments dated 4/21/77. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstad?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Crowe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Move the bill to the floor to pass.
Let me ask this. On line 11, have we adopted the amendment increasing, changing 10 weeks to 14 weeks? Do you recall, or was there any change made in that?
No.
Okay.
This goes to Ways and Means, doesn't it?
Yes, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senator Crowe moves Senate Bill 988 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Ways and Means.
To the Ways and Means. It has subsequent referral. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Jernstad?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Crowe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 944. Are these?
Mr. Chairman, Brad Swank from Legislative Council is here also.
What's that?
Brad Swank from Legislative Council.
Okay, Brad, do you want to go over those?
Oh, this is not Brad.
Oh.
I'm not Brad.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm Bill Goss from Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, representing the Multnomah County and the Oregon Security Association.
Have you seen these amendments?
We've just read them now, yes, and we have seen them prior to this, but this is the first time they've been engrossed, and we support them.
Okay. Is Senator Carson,
sure.
Have you seen the amendments to...
I just sneaked up on
Brad. Brad, would you go over the amendments with us?
Whose amendments are they, Mr. Chairman? Committees?
They were I don't know they were requested by.
Mr. Chairman, should I identify myself for the record? My name is Brad Swank. I'm a Deputy Legislative Counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
There are a number of amendments that were made.
These amendments were requested by Senator Attia, is that true?
Some of the amendments were requested by Senator Attia. I was directed to draft some of the other amendments at the last hearing in which this bill was held.
Okay.
And to consult with the people from the telephone company, from the railroads, and from the security industries, and from the sheriffs to make sure that
you've taken care of their problem.
As far as I know, I've worked with all of them and discussed
and
with
satisfied.
All of them, and they seem to be satisfied. Do you want me to just start at the beginning of
the amendment? Yes, if there's anything new and as briefly as possible. Mm-hmm.
All right. The first change that was made from the bill as originally printed was in the definition of proprietary security, essentially. That definition has changed read, means performance of security service by individuals employed by a person that are performed solely for that person. Changes the definition from limiting a person to performing proprietary security on his own premises.
Where do we find that? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Is there a question?
Where do you find that in the amendments? It was a question.
Okay.
Where are we? That's the wrong one.
That's the change on line 20. The first change in the amendments was a change that was necessary. I'll just start at the beginning of the amendments, I guess. The first, on page 2 of the printed bill, line 18, delete A and insert any political. That was changed to include all local governments in the state of Oregon. As the second change is part of that. In line 20, the change that was made from the original printed bill was changed for the railroad people and the... Do you know where we are now?
I'm at the foggiest notion. Okay.
Grant,
they're looking at the bills. Yeah, but he's citing
okay.
line numbers, and I'm working off this document.
So you have we have the amendments, the problem, we have the amendments, and then we have the bill itself. And,
are you going off the regular, the original bill?
Yeah, the bill has not been printed up in engrossed form yet.
Okay.
This is just a typed copy that was prepared by our office to make it easier for you to...
But you're going off the regular bill?
I was.
Okay.
And the amendments.
All right.
All right. Question, Mr. Chairman. I'll go off the engrossed bill as it would be easier for you.
Senator Turnstead has a question.
And the definition of proprietary security, it says performance of a security services by individuals employed by a person. You want to narrow it to that?
There is a statutory definition of person in Chapter 144 that includes corporations, associations, etc.
And we're clear that that applies to the...
It does apply to this. All right. The first major change that was made was in the definition of proprietary security. And that change was, the change was made from a definition where proprietary security means the employment of individuals by a person to perform security services for that person on his own premises, to means the performance of security service by individuals employed by a person that are performed solely for that person. The change was made for the telephone company and the railroad company so they could perform some security services off their own premises. That was their concern.
Could I have somebody speak to the firearm requirement? I guess that's an important part. That's in the present bill, and it's also retained in the amendment that proprietary security does not include somebody who has a firearm.
No, it doesn't.
Why? Can somebody...
That's the way I was asked to draft it.
Yeah, I realize that's a policy decision.
Perhaps. Senator Carson, the provision, or what we intended on this, was that if a proprietary security officer was to carry a gun that was not concealed, of course, then that they would have to meet the requirements of the training.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The next change that was made was a change in that section from the bill as printed on proprietary security, and a change in the next section on private security businesses. The changes were made to delete the requirement for uniforms, a proprietary security under the change, a proprietary security service under the changes can wear a uniform without having to be licensed. Those deletions were made. The next change that was made was in the definition under subsection 10 of Section 1, there were some additions made to the description of burglar alarm services to make it clear that these were only burglar alarm response services that did not include repairs or installations of burglar alarms, just response thereto. The next change from the printed bill was a change in that same subsection, deleting the requirement that any activity where a uniform is used be licensed as a private security business. Again, this is for the people that are interested in proprietary security business, I guess, who want to wear uniforms. The next change that was made was a change in Section 3. The first three sections were changed and reworded somewhat to make them read a little bit more easily, and the first section, to the first section, wording was added to cover any person appointed or commissioned by the governor to perform law enforcement services or security services. That was added at the request, that was language that was added because the railroad people were interested in having their people exempted from the act, and the people they are concerned about are commissioned by the governor. So under that, they are exempted. And to that same section, a subsection 6 was added to more clearly express the exemption of proprietary security. In Section 5, there was additional language added to the first sentence of subsection 1 to make it clear that the board had to establish classes for activities within license and certificates for all separable classes of security services. In Section 7, a change was made to make it clear that people who were certified certificate holders, and these are the people that work for the licensees, but the people who were certified could perform, if they were certified in the private investigation specialization, any.
Right, just a minute. Are the committee, are they satisfied? I mean, we've gone through them. I don't think there's any earth-shaking change as far as the amendments are concerned. They're more clarifying.
Well, there are some additional sections that are added in the amendments at the back. Would you rather me?
I would rather. Why don't you go to those? And
are there any objections to any of these amendments?
I'm not reading.
Huh?
I'd like to finish reading.
Well, I know that, but I don't know if that's
meaningful. None that I know of, as far as
change.
You want to go to the new section? Where do they start?
Okay, I should mention that changes were made as requested by Senator Roberts in the definition of moral character. Those were changed to character standards set by the board, and the board was given power to set character standards.
That's an improvement?
It's broad, but it's the only way I could think to meet the requirements.
Oh, I knew that was going to say. Well, after we've had all the plays on the word broad, what kind of experiences has the board had in setting character standards?
Well, moral character is a term that's in most licensing statutes. The reason it's
We've been busily taking it out, as I was saying to you, and I was just wondering why you're putting this one in,
okay.
But we're busy taking them
the
out.
Thing the thing that's been taken out that I'm aware of is the reference to moral turpitude in the revocation of licenses. This is moral character, which is put in the granting of licenses.
Which is the opposite of moral turpitude.
Well, no, moral the thing that they do under moral character is, I know the bar, they check your credit references, your criminal record, those sorts of things, and there's no catchphrase for describing what they do.
Can call it checking your criminal record and checking your credit record.
Can I leave with confidence that
except
I be taken up
I don't know all of the sorts of things that
you
they're
leave?
That they yeah, need I to can. Check. And if they have to set standards, I guess they'd have to do it by rule. It's a difficult area to try and determine what they need. Right now, most boards, in my understanding, just look at whatever they can get a hold of and make some kind of decision as to whether the person has moral character, whatever that is.
And they decide that on the basis of whether or not they're divorced or not? Is that considered part of moral character?
I don't know what all they consider right now in most boards. It's one of the problems that we're having in drafting licensing bills, that there are really no standards set. I thought by going to having the board set standards, at least they'd have to be written out.
Well, I think that one of my concerns was that if you could say that they could require references as to a person's past job performance in the job, their reliability, whether they showed themselves to be trustworthy, you could require those kinds of references, or references which would give some indication of whether or not the individual was who they said they were, or who, you know, if they had lived in the city for a period of time, a reference that would essentially prove that, give some that kind of background. But I'm just a little concerned about that language, and I'm not concerned on it because I think that if it were abused, it would probably be challenged, and you would find that the moral character thing had no real standing, because it is difficult to define. But I don't, you know, in other words, you're putting into statute something that I don't think you're going to be able to use.
Okay, most in administrative...
If challenged, you certainly aren't going to.
In administrative law, most courts are going away from the setting of standards and statutes and going to due process. Because standards are difficult to set in statutory language. This is an administrative area of the law, and the change from moral character to having the board set standards does have them at least
sit down and think about. I'm saying that is somewhat of an improvement. What page of the amendments is that new language on?
It's in several pages. It's in section 11 in two places. In section 14, in section 16, in section 20, and in section 21.
They meet the character standards set by the board is the language used in each place?
Except in the last section that I mentioned, which is section 31, is a section which makes requirements for the board, and that requires the board to determine character standards as part of their rulemaking procedures.
Any further questions?
Did you want me to go on the other sections that were added?
Yeah, as quickly.
All right. A new section was added as section 20A.
What is it, 20?
20A. And this section allows municipal police chiefs or sheriffs to suspend a certificate without a hearing. This was requested by the sheriffs, and I drafted the language to try and meet their requirements. It requires the sheriffs to meet the to make the determination set forth in subsection 1 in order to suspend a certificate and to notify the board and the certificate holder as provided in subsection 2. Subsection 3 requires that a certificate holder who's been notified no longer practice any act that's required to be certified under the bill. And section 4 deals with the problems of suspending the license of a certified manager because licensees are required to have certified managers who supervise the activities of certificate holders and operatives in their business. The next new section that was added was section 21A. On page 25 of the proposed A and B bill, this permits licensees to issue temporary certificates themselves without having to go to the board if there is some activity that they need to have an operative perform.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, I would move these amendments, and then maybe we could have the bill engrossed for further consideration.
Okay, Senator Crow moves the adoption of the amendments. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. We have to get down to the floor. We'll have the bill engrossed, and we'll probably have to have another work session on this particular bill. And House Bill 209, Attorney General Redden has asked us to hold that bill up for a few days until he gets more information on it. Senate Bill 385, we'll get on to that at our next session, and we are adjourned.